You know, the first question I have for you is, you began your professional career with the Raiders in 1960. And at the time, the Raiders were one of the few underfunded teams in the new AFL. What were your initial impressions of the team and then what you could tell about the league?
Well, the first impression of the team was that it was a... it was kind of a organized, disorganized function of football. The participants were guys that loved the game for the game, not necessarily the money, because the money was not that great. And neither was the money in the NFL that great at the time, because everybody in those days that played football had to have an off-season job just to survive, otherwise you'd never make it. So it was a fun time in our lives because we were doing something we all love to do, and those of us that had some vision realized that it was a challenge too, because we were being challenged to fail by the NFL.
Right. Did you go so far as to think or give the AFL a chance of succeeding? What did you think the chances were that, you know, after 1960 you would still be playing football?
Well, there was some doubt. You know, some of the there was always some rumors. You know, the New York Titans were in trouble financially with Eric Whisper, and the Raiders weren't doing that great, but we weren't aware of it. You know, we got paid on time. One time we had to sit at the bank while the money was being deposited so we could draw our paychecks. Teams were open. We still didn't have a home because we were still at that time still playing in San Francisco. So we were playing at Kezar Stadium, and then we went to Candlestick. We finally got a home in 1962, although it being a very small, almost like a high school field, while they were negotiating the building of the Coliseum.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some light at the end of the tunnel, and we just kept plugging along. And we knew that, you know, when we had some of the players that we had in those days, that we had quality players. We maybe didn't have as many as the NFL, but we had quality players. And because of the direction of the league and some of the big players in the league, like Sid Gilman, Mike Al Davis, Hank Stram, we were able to get some pretty good players. And because they came, you know, the perception that because they came in the AFL, all of a sudden they weren't quality players, that was a bunch of bull.
You know, you touched on one of my next questions just now, actually, in that the Raiders were pretty much a transient team in the early 60s. You had different practice fields. You played at different game fields. How much did that disrupt you guys as a team and what you were trying to accomplish? Or was it something that you were able to just kind of put out of your mind?
Well, I think we handled it pretty good, to be honest with you. It could have been a disruption, but we were so eager to play the game our passion was the game of football. Those of us that were involved, some of the guys that were former NFL players, it was pretty obvious they were just playing for a paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
But those of us pretty young, like Jim Otto and myself and a bunch of guys that were, you know, pioneers, Jack Kemp, we organized our own player association. We were trying to do things that were positive.
Mm-hmm.
Using the NFL as a model, obviously, but we had the one thing that we always had was we never fought the owners. We didn't hate the owners like the NFL did. We embraced the owners, and most of them, with very few exceptions, embraced us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were trying to do what was good for the league, not necessarily fighting them. You know, the NFL was in kind of a little anarchy in those days because they had their player association that was fairly new, and they had tough owners like George Halas was a tough owner, Preston Marshall was a tough owner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the last seem to integrate. So there was a lot of things going on that they controlled, and they didn't want us to disrupt what they had.
Okay. You played first for Eddie Ertelatz and then Marty Feldman before Al took over in 1963. What those coaches were not terribly successful. What do you think, looking back now as a former player and as well as a head coach, what were their major failures, do you think?
The major failures, so we weren't getting enough of the good competitive players. I mean, in 1960, we were all pretty well equal because everybody was new. You know, mm-hmm. And we, Ertelatz was a conditioned kind of a disciplinary coach because he had coached at Navy, and they were limited on time, and we ran everywhere, and we went fast. So we were in great shape, and we just kind of out-hustled teams to win our six games that year. Where we weren't as good as them, but we just out-hustled them, especially the second half. And in 61, we signed one player that we had drafted, and he wasn't even very good.
Mm-hmm.
Where everybody else was signing players. The Chargers were signing, you know, Earl Faison, and they brought in Ernie Ladd,
mm-hmm.
and you know, Lance Allworth. I mean, and they were signing quality players, and we weren't. And that's why we just went down the next few years, 61 and 62. There was not a lot of money, and there wasn't anybody direct to the team that knew what the hell they were doing.
Okay.
And that was the perfect entrance for Al Davis to come because he knew football. It was his lifelong passion. He had learned under sympathy, you know, under Sid Gilman, and he was an incredible studier of the game. He picked your brain to death. He started that long time ago and what to do, and an evaluator of talent.
I consider you to be one of 20 players that played all 10 years of the AFL, although technically you sat out in 1962 with tuberculosis. Talk about what was kind of going through your mind when you got that diagnosis and you know, not only how it affected you as a player, but you had a young family at the time did the Raiders help to cover your health costs and things like that? What was it like back then as a football player with something like that happening to you?
Well, it was devastating because, you know, my wife had to have some issues during pregnancy. She had hepatitis and at one point almost lost the twins. And then, so she went through a pretty tiring time when she had the twins, and then two months after they were born, I'm in the hospital with TB, and in a month, 2 months after that, we had nothing. We had bills to pay. We had no insurance in those days, no hospitalization. We had no hospitalization for the birth, so we were still paying off our babies, and no job. And the doctors, I was devastated. I mean, I was, I didn't know what to do, but I knew that you had to do something. So we actually ended up moving in with my in-laws for the rest of that year, and I started to get myself physically ready to play when the doctors let me. Because I thought there was no question in my mind that I was going to come back. Doctors didn't think so, but I did, and they didn't tell me. Thank God they didn't tell me.
Mm-hmm.
But so I just did what I had to. My wife went back to teaching. We clipped a lot of coupons. I did the feedings and stayed home with the kids. She went to work.
Well, you guys bounced back.
But I followed the game. I was at every home game. I even wrote a little article for the Open Tribune at the time, from the eyes of a football player,
mm-hmm.
and for the home games anyway. So yeah, I was staying on top of the game itself. And it was painful because we were not very good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you guys bounced back in 63. I mean, you had, you know, what's arguably your best season of your career. Al came in and took over and changed things around. You guys brought in Art Powell, who had a tremendous year. Talk about all the things that went into making that year such an incredible turnaround from what you were used to the first 3 years with the Raiders.
Well, the one thing that we felt right off the bat was that this guy knows what he's talking about. Uh-huh. Even my very first meeting with him, I spent about an hour, and he was going over the offense. This is what we're going to do, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. I smiled. He even asked me, "What do you smile at?" I said, "I like what you're doing on the board." I was laughing at him behind his back. And then when we went to training camp, he worked our butts off. We were there a long, long time, but we knew that he knew. And he was doing everything he could. He brought in players and brought in some good players, players who could play the game. And we kind of stuck up on a few people, but he taught us how to win.
Mm-hmm.
And we were being taught the opposite, how to just show up and not go through the motions, but, you know, in futility because we didn't have enough players, but he showed us how to win, and we did. We had a good year that year, and coming off of a 1-13 season to a 10-4 is an incredible rebound.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all of a sudden we come out of the season, no playoffs because the system didn't allow it those days.
Mm-hmm.
But we knew that this was the right direction, and we bought in.
Okay. You had mentioned earlier how Al had came from San Diego previously and had been around Sid Gilman, and you know I've talked to Sid when he was alive and many of his players about how they respected Al and Al's knowledge and his work ethic. Talk about how you think Al felt about Sid Gilman and the Chargers and what was, how much did Sid influence him?
I think Sid influenced him a lot. I mean, they were very good friends, and in later years, they even became stronger friends. Sid would come up to some games, and Al would talk to him a lot on the phone, and kept him engaged in football to some in any capacity, because that's what Sid was. I mean, without football, you know, Sid, he even used to send him film to look at,
mm-hmm.
that he could stay engaged in. And they always talked highly of him, with respect and friendship, and Al was like a sponge, boy. You tell him anything, and he would remember it for life. So
mm-hmm.
whatever any coach told him along his life and upbringing, he remembered it, and if he liked it, he incorporated it in his philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
If he did, just put it aside.
Uh-huh. You know, it's funny you mentioned that. I had an opportunity to interview Al for about 30 minutes when I was writing my book on the early Chargers. And this was, the interview was done in 2004. And I was blown away by his recall, talking about the players that he had scouted, what high schools they went to, what colleges they went to, their wives' names, their girlfriends' names. I mean, he was telling me about watching Keith Lincoln play football at Monrovia High School and how he was disappointed that he couldn't get him to go to USC, and Keith went up to Washington instead. I was absolutely amazed at how good his memory was for, you know, players, when he's seen thousands of players over the 50 years since then, but he still had great recollection of those early years and those early players.
He was a master at that. I mean, during draft, at this time of year when you're getting ready for the draft, I mean, his retention was just incredible. I mean, he you sit there and spiral at all the stuff that he can remember, but you bring up a player and things that you're talking about. He was good. He was one of the best.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You were traded to the Bills in 1967 with Art Powell. The Bills had three really strong years prior to you getting there in 67, and then kind of went on the decline after that for quite a while. What was it like to be back in Buffalo and playing for a different team and a different squad and really in a different situation? You know, you were backing up Jack Kemp at that point and very different from what you had in Oakland the years previously.
Well, I went there and they brought me in to compete against Jack, and so we did. We competed all the preseason, and I actually won the starting job. Mm-hmm. Started the very first game against the Jets, and I got hurt.
Mm-hmm.
I sprained my knee, so I was sidelined, and then I could never really get back in the had other issues that came up. So I never could get back into the starting lineup. And then the next year, my second year, I got hurt again. I had to have surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And for the 2 years in a row, I'm on the sideline. And people aren't very happy because the Bronco is tearing them up and open with a team that I helped build.
Uh-huh.
That was a disappointment to me because I knew and I felt this team is ready to win and win big.
Mm-hmm.
And I was right. And Daryl did a wonderful job with them, but I always felt that I could have done the same thing.
Uh-huh.
It didn't happen or anything. So, I ended up on the sideline, disappointed, and the team was in decline also. That we started getting hurt.
Right.
A good, strong offensive line to a weak offensive line with injuries, and then the defense was starting to get some rust on them. So, that was one of the reasons. The defense was always one of the strengths.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden they weren't. The defense, the running game, but all of a sudden they weren't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. From Buffalo, you went to Kansas City and played behind Len Dawson. Talk about the differences between Kemp and Dawson as leaders and quarterbacks. Obviously, both very talented guys and strong leaders. But what were some of the similarities they had and some of the differences as well?
Well, Lenny was a lot more quiet. He was a quiet type guy. He was good play action and not as much of a politician as Jack was. Jack was a big time politician.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As he moved later in life. In fact, when I was in Buffalo, I was one of the player reps, and I was in my second year there. I was hurt. Jack was hurt. We were out for the year, so he and I conducted all the business for the player association. He was the president of the association. We did actually negotiated a contract with the AFL owners for the remaining 2 years of our contract before the merger.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, you could tell Jack was destined for the political world because just the way he handled himself. I mean, we were very close friends, good friends. We roomed together and remained good friends through the years. So when I went to Kansas City, I went there when Lenny got hurt. That's the reason that they picked me up. And he missed six games. And I got to know him, but he was very quiet, good guy, didn't say much. Very bright, very quiet leader.
Mm-hmm.
In so many ways. Very accurate in his play action, and he'd been in that system, and he knew the system very well. Hankstram was a very organized coach, and we had really good players.
Mm-hmm. When you went to Kansas City, the Chiefs won Super Bowl IV that year, and right before the merger, obviously they ended up with the AFL versus the NFL had a 2-2 record. They split the four Super Bowls. Talk about what it meant to you as a longtime AFL man to, at the time of the merger, to have an equal Super Bowl record with the NFL. How important was it to AFL people that you ended with that kind of parody?
Well, those of us that grew up in the AFL, and especially the 20 guys that started in 1960,
mm-hmm.
you know, we were very proud of what we had accomplished. And when the Jets won, you know, we were actually, I watched a game from Palm Springs. We were there with a combination of NFL players and AFL players, and we were starting the merger of our two foundations, our two associations.
Mm-hmm.
And we all watched the game together, and you know, everybody felt that it was going to be a cakewalk. And then, especially when Joe predicted and guaranteed that they would win, and you know, we were very quiet and humble. And other than Nick Bonacani, Nick was always—he was never quiet. He was always very vocal. And but when it did happen, as we were watching it, and happened it before our eyes, I thought it was great. I mean, we were very proud. And the guys in the room from the NFL—they were great about it. They were really good about it. They said, "You guys kick your butts."
Mm-hmm.
Great trip, big game, and the ones that were the most upset were the wives.
Oh, yeah?
Really? I don't know why. I mean, but they were like, how dare you? You know? So they had been a little brainwashed themselves. And then so when we came back and won Super Bowl IV, I mean, that was even close.
Uh-huh.
That gave up. When I'm watching the tapes and getting ready for that game, and I said, there's no way this team can beat us. I said, we're just too good. There's no way.
Huh.
And they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Our defense was way too strong for them. And then some of the things that we did offensively just kind of baffled it. They were a pretty vanilla team anyway, and we were just better than they were.
Mm-hmm.
Although they had some real good players.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me, obviously you dealt a lot, especially in the early years, with the AFL being called a Mickey Mouse League and having subpar players and all of that. In your estimation, what was the first AFL championship team that would have beaten an NFL championship team of the same year?
Other than before the Jets did it, you mean?
Right. Before the Jets.
I thought in 1963 the Chargers were good though.
Yeah.
I didn't think. Yeah, the Bears had that great defense, but their offense couldn't score a touchdown.
Uh-huh.
I thought that team would have had a pretty good chance. You know.
Mm-hmm.
When we went to Super Bowl I, the Packers were just an outstanding football team. They were like a machine.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fact that they beat, you know, they beat the Chiefs. You know, they beat everybody in their league too. So it was, you know, it wasn't, you know, the Chiefs weren't just good enough. They weren't good enough to beat them. They were just too. They were good, but they weren't good enough to beat the Packers. The Packers were just so well trained and so well disciplined that they were just.
For the best. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Tell me, Al Davis obviously has a reputation for being a challenging guy to work with. What was tougher for you, being a player for Al Davis or being a coach for Al Davis?
Coach.
Yeah? Why?
Because you never went home. At least as a player, practice is over, and you had a little respite between the next practice.
Mm-hmm.
And other than the quarterbacks meeting we had, you know, it's just a different relationship when you're a coach. You know, he's around and he's relentless as far as, you know, bending your ear and sitting there and especially late at night. He was a night person.
Uh-huh.
So he would come in as you're working late at night, he was, when I was an assistant coach, and he'd just start talking. And we're trying to get our, you know, John Madden was in his office, and we had already met, and we're trying to get our stuff together and get the game plan ready and making some other notes and cut-ups and stuff. And here's Al just asking all these questions and going over some of his ideas, which he loved to throw in. And we're trying to finish up so we can go home in a decent hour. So we had to be back early in the morning.
Uh-huh.
He did. He didn't get up till 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. So it was, and it was around the clock, and also it was 7 days a week.
Uh-huh.
So as a player, you never had that kind of contact with him. But besides that, yeah, Todd, there's no comparison between coaching and playing. Playing was the best.
Yeah. Yeah.
They'll always be the best part of my life. I mean, played the game, and then coaching was second. Yeah.
Okay.
Ownership would be pretty good, but I never got to that level.
Yeah. Okay. So the next section of questions that I've got are not really questions, but what I'd like to do is just name. I've got about 8 names here of guys that you played with. And I'd just like you to kind of give me your thoughts on them, whether it's ideas of how they were as ball players or how they were off the field or whatever kind of comes to mind, however you think about these guys. And right. The first one is Ben Davidson.
Ben was a true warrior, overachiever. You know, kind of a clumsy guy that was trying to grow into his body, so we got him. And Al put him at a defensive end and you know, let him play our style, you know, let him go after the quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
And Ben became a very good player, and he was a very loyal and he was about as big a team guy as he ever wanted. If you ever invited him to an event, he would always be there. To the very end of his life, when we're all celebrating the death of Al Davis in Las Vegas, all, you know, all the bunch of Raiders came back. He called up and said he couldn't, said, don't hold the room because I can't make it. I'm not feeling too good. And then he died.
Mm-hmm.
So he was always thinking of the team. He was one of the best ambassadors football ever had.
Yeah. Yeah. What about Dave Grayson?
Dave Grayson was a very intelligent corner, kind of a very smooth, a little undersized in height, but very intellectual, and that's why he played the game quite well, because of his intelligence and his quickness. He didn't have great speed, but he had excellent quickness, and he was very smart.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Very classy guy, too.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Yeah. Art Powell.
Art was kind of a played with a chip on his shoulder, kind of lived life with a chip on his shoulder. I played with his older brother, Charlie Powell, in the first 2 years
mm-hmm.
of the Raiders. And they were complete opposites.
Yeah.
But Art was as gifted as a receiver as you ever want. He was kind of ahead of his time because he was a big receiver,
mm-hmm.
and speed, deceptive speed. He could go up in the air for the ball. He just throw it close to him, he could go get it. So he was, but he always had a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. We became very good friends, in time. But he was not an easy guy to get to know.
Uh huh. The next name I had was actually Art's brother, Charlie Powell.
Oh, Charlie was just a wonderful guy. Charlie was the old vet, you know, just trying to get another paycheck and played pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's a guy that never went to college and played pro ball already as a teenager, I think, with the Niners.
Right.
And when he came, you know, he gave us a lot of advice, you know, just by talking.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of showed us a little bit about the negativity that the blacks had in the South, but when they weren't going to serve us one time, when we went to play Dallas, or they weren't going to serve the blacks until the Earl had spread these law that we're leaving, the whole team's leaving. So they had to change their policy.
Hmm.
We had about, maybe two or three blacks, and Charlie was one of them. And, you know, he took it well. I mean, he didn't, he said, this is the way it is. You got to learn to live with this right now. Where Art would have rebelled. You know, Art would have, God bless his soul, he just passed away a couple of weeks ago.
Right. Don Manoukian.
Those of us that grew up in California, we had never experienced anything like that. And so that was all new to us.
Sure.
But when we played Texas in Dallas, you'd think that the Hilton on the team that we could have gotten in the Hilton Hotel, no, we had to stay outside of Dallas. In a little town, I can't remember the name of the town.
Don Manoukian.
The Bruiser. The Bruiser was, Don and I played the Eastern Shrine Game together. That's where I went to college with his younger brother. Noel Manoukian.
Okay.
So I knew I had already known the family, and I knew Don. And then when he played with us that one year, he was just fun to be around. Because he was so clever and bright and witty, and he was a tough, good football player. Although, he was only 5'9", I think, or something like that. but he was so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a good player, but he only played the one year because he said, I could make more money wrestling than I can play football, which he did. And we missed him, but he really one of the most intelligent guys we ever had. He was a Stanford grad, dogged out of the corner of his mouth like the wrestler does. but what he had to, he was articulate and really intelligent and a dear, dear friend. And we just lost him last year, too.
Right. Jim Otto.
We're losing too many guys, Todd.
Yeah, no, that's
I just saw Jim yesterday. I just saw him yesterday, and he was at the Lepitas Journal. He can't play anymore, but he's still cheerful as ever. You never know that he's had as many problems as he's had. He talks about them and laughs. And I brought up a jersey that a friend of mine had been in mothballs for since 1965. It was our original jerseys. Mm. When Al came, he changed the jersey.
Right.
So I had mine, and we had had they had used them for some banquet, and they had been in the restaurant jurors, one of his boxes forever. So I got mine a couple of years back, and my wife framed it, and then all of a sudden he said, oh, I just found Jim Otto's. You want his, do this, and that, which we saw. I took it out to him. And you knew that they were the original one because they had patches of soul marks all over the place. They never got the jerseys in those days. We just sew up the old one until it just was a piece of rag.
Right.
But that, Jim was about as tough guy, and you could tell he was going to go. The very first day of training camp, he came in as a linebacker.
Uh-huh.
He was only on 218, 220, so 228, and he was going to be a middle linebacker. And all of a sudden, he started snapping the ball, he could long snap, and then he was started talking. And boy, did he have a punch. He could sing me. So they said, Mama, you're going to be the center. And it was a good choice on the Erdlund staff. Ernie George was a fine coach. And he had been Erdlund's coach at Navy. And his right-hand man, he actually ran the offense. Very bright, and he made the move. We were pretty solid in the middle of those 2 years. We had Wayne Hawkins and Otto and Lincoln. I was taller than all of them. but they were tough in the middle.
What about Dan Birdwell?
Birdie was a unique guy. It's just he was Well, he was kind of like a bull in a china shop. He'd come in, and in the process of walking into your room, he'd probably tip over a chair, knock over a lamp,
mm-hmm.
and light a cigarette, throw the ashes at the floor. And you loved him. Everybody loved him. He had huge, humongous hands. And they were just powerful. He could whack you across the head, which they couldn't those days. Defensive linemen. And they didn't know what to do with him. He was a linebacker, offensive lineman. You know, they were trying to find a spot because he was not a real big guy. He was only about 235 pounds. Raw. Kind of very etiquette was not an issue because he had no etiquette. he was just a good old boy from Houston, and he was tough as hell. Mm-hmm. He didn't know what pain was. I mean, mm-hmm. he could withstand pain, knock you on your back, and then pick you up.
Mm-hmm.
He'll pick you up. So when Al came to town, he put him down at the down line and played him on an overtime defense where he played opposite the tight end most of the time. And just was told to whack the tight end. You know, his first move, head slap, which was legal those days.
Mm-hmm.
One game, we played it over and over because he head slapped the tight end on his way to the quarterback, and the tight end ran about 5 yards and fell down. Reaction. he dazed him with a powerful right hand and just slapped him. And if you asked him, Gertie, why'd you do that? I don't know, I just did it. You know, he couldn't even explain why.
Uh-huh.
He had done. And then the problem was that he would do that in practice, but he had to remind him, Gertie, Daddy, practice. Oh, okay. Just step on everybody's toes and go ahead.
Well, I've learned.
He's one of the most unique guys, fun guys to be around. And we're in training camp. We're daddy. You know, we're all playing around between practices. He's out underneath the car, fixing his car. It's 90 degrees out. He's laying under his car, fixing an oil pan or something nasty.
Well, I've learned in my AFL research that when I run across an old Raider, one of the questions I have to ask is, what's your favorite Dan Birdwell story?
Well, I'm trying to think what my what one is that I could tell. I'll tell you, one of mine is we're having a pregame meal. And it's a home game, so we're having a pregame meal. The food wasn't that great those days because the budget wasn't very good. So no one liked to sit next to him when he ate because he ate, you know, in about 4 bites and he was done with dinner. So he cut his feet in half, and it was a thick, like a hamburger steak. We always call it Mr. Meat.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, God, this meat stinks. He had his half of the meat in his fork. And he said, smell it. And he hit me right in the nose. Hit me right in the nose with the hamburger steak and the juices coming out my nose. I said, yeah, Daddy, it's big. But then he proceeded to eat the goddamn thing. And then he proceeded to get the dry heaves in between because he was nervous. But I can't. Needless to say, Don, my meal was rude. Okay. And then another time, he lost somebody, his last dog.
Mm-hmm.
And then he comes into our room, Pop Davis and I room together. He said, we did the attempts. He came in, he wanted to borrow a car. Because he wanted to do something with it. But that's the way that's the kind of guy he was.
Uh-huh. All right, last name is Clem Daniels.
Clem Daniels, we got in 1961. He was with the Dallas the Hank Stram's team.
Mm-hmm.
And and they cut them, and we picked them up, and they had him playing, I think they had him playing linebacker, I think. And we put him up, you know, our guys put him in the backfield as a fullback. And I said, you know, you'd watch him, it was pretty obvious that he could run at great speed, at good size, and I think it was about 215, 217. That's pretty good size for a back in those days. And so he played out the year. He wasn't a starter, but he was on the team. And played special teams and, you know, very talented. You can see the talent in practice. And then when Al came, he moved to the halfback.
You there?